It is Monday, September 2nd, 2013, and this is episode 33 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. Just a reminder, the thoughts and opinions I express on this podcast are mine and do not represent those of my employer. I'm down a co-host this week as Mr. Kellett is off playing with dragons. Well, happy Labor Day to my friends in the United States. Unfortunately, I think my wife misunderstands what Labor Day actually is, so this podcast is a little bit late because I've been repainting and gutting rooms and whatnot. The first story I have tonight is a follow-up to one we talked about a couple of weeks ago, and this was about the Department of Energy announcing that they had been hacked. And at the time, there wasn't a lot of detail about what actually happened. Some reporter came across a memo, an internal memo from the Department of Energy, which hasn't been formally acknowledged, but some insider sources apparently have confirmed. So this story is on Information Week, and basically the internal story is that a cold fusion vulnerability on a public-facing web server was exploited. And if this sounds familiar, it really should, because there have been quite a number, especially government sites, in the past probably 8 months being compromised through cold fusion bugs. And what I thought was particularly telling on this one was a comment made by, again, a confidential informant that the management at the Department of Energy often complains that there just isn't enough money to fix some of these bugs. And I think in the context of what they were specifically talking about was some poor hygiene around how their user IDs and passwords are compiled. Apparently, social security numbers play a part in their username, which is pretty bad form. But as with most enterprises, once you make a significant investment in your technology, it becomes real difficult to allocate money on really something that you hadn't planned to invest in. And, you know, throughout my career, I've seen this happen quite a lot, and it's a little frustrating. And what I mean is, a company will, or organization will, invest a lot of money in a business system, and they intend for that business system to be around for a long time. You know, potentially decade or more. And the problem is they don't really see past the initial development and rollout. They may understand that there's this ongoing care and feeding, but one of the challenges is that they're often involving a lot of customization. And so the development cost initially involves quite a lot of custom programming or configuration and whatnot. And what happens is you become locked into a particular version or a particular platform, and as subsequent releases come out for that technology, it is not a trivial thing to move to the next version. And we see that a lot with things like Oracle Financials and PeopleSoft and those things. They're very, very tailored to the environment that they're deployed in, and it's a significant investment in resources and effort to upgrade to the next version. And certainly some platforms are better than others at this, I'll give you that. But as a rule, what I've seen is an organization will push some large system like this out there, it'll sit around for quite some time. At some point, people change, the management changes, and that application is no longer viewed as, quote, strategic. and people don't want to spend any money on it anymore. And so when something like this comes around, we find out that there's a critical vulnerability in ColdFusion, the decision is, hey, you know what? Let's not put any more money in this thing that we want to get rid of anyway. Let's put all of our effort behind the strategic replacement, which is, you know, 7 years away. And in the meantime, you have this application that gets owned. I'm not saying that's exactly what happened here. I'm just saying that I've seen this story play out time and time again. And my point is that when an organization adopts an application like this, it's kind of like adopting a kid or getting into a relationship. It takes ongoing commitment and resources and investment to keep it healthy. Otherwise, things like this will happen. So all that to say, if you ever find yourself as the CIO of a company and you're considering putting an application in, make sure that you're really comprehending the whole life cycle of costs here. It's not all about the initial deployment and configuration and whatnot, and plus some minor ongoing care and feeding operational type support. You really need to bake in costs to do major upgrades as time goes by. They're inevitable, and inevitably people don't accommodate for them. So the rest of the stories here tonight have a common theme, and the common theme is social engineering. The first story I want to bring up is a report that was referenced on a CSO Online article. And the headline of it is that 30% of Americans will open emails even if they know the message is malicious. And so consider that in the context of what we as defenders are up against when we think about one of the really major threat vectors is phishing and watering hole attacks. You know, what we've debated mightily about whether investing in security awareness education is even worth it, because, hey, you know, it's a person. It's not a machine. People will do what people do. And, you know, I've often been of the mind that if it doesn't have a gigantic cost and it does yield some increased benefits, then it probably has a place. But this really does point out that, you know, no matter how good your awareness education program is, people are curious and people are going to do irrational things. And I think that's what this report to me really says, is that people are somewhat irrational. And even if somebody comes to me and says, hey, you know what, I got this email and it has an attachment that says it's a video of Osama bin Laden being killed. Do you think it's legitimate? And I tell them, no, I think it's probably a virus. 30% of them are going to open it. And so that kind of goes back to, ultimately, we need, as a panacea, as a Garden of Eden, if you will, a place where people can do what they will and not be putting their organizations at risk. And I know that that's just totally utopic and completely irrational, but anything less, and we have some risk, right? People are going to click on the links, even if they know they're bad. And not everyone, not all the time, but some of them will some of the time. And in the absence of that, hey, we've got a problem. Now, whether you do anything about the problem is going to entirely depend on your organization and their tolerance for risk and the nature of the data they have at risk and whatnot. And so that dovetails into the second story, which is about the probably by now very well-known, very high-profile attack by the Syrian Electronic Army on the New York Times and one of Twitter's domains. You know, I've had a lot of discussions at my job about this particular situation with the Syrian Electronic Army. And, you know, my assessment is this, you know, the Syrian Electronic Army is not an incredibly sophisticated group by other country standards. So if you compare them against, let's say, the United States or many other major developed countries, from a cyber perspective, they're not all that sophisticated, but what they can do, they do damn well, and they know how to do it and how to leverage it in lots of different cases. And so what we see here is a very common tactic that they've refined, which is social engineering via email, is extending beyond their normal MO of taking over the Twitter feeds of media outlets, or taking over the blog pages of media outlets and whatnot. And what they did here was they socially engineered a domain reseller for Melbourne IT, and that reseller apparently had access to modify the domain records of the New York Times and of one of Twitter's domains. And I bring this up for a couple of reasons. Number one, even if you nail the whole user awareness, security awareness education in your organization, you're not out of the woods, because you often have pretty significant reliance on third parties. And a lot of times you have no concept of how vulnerable they are. And I think the other interesting thing to me is, in what this case shows, is that you can have the most secure website, web platform, web application imaginable, and an attacker doesn't actually have to do anything. They don't have to attack that platform to call you hacked, right? All they've got to do is hack your domain registrar and point your DNS servers to theirs, and then your website gets pointed to their website. And all of a sudden, visitors to your site are getting their page. Your emails are going to their mail server. They're able to send out email as your domain, and so on and so on. So I bring this up because I think it's important as security people that we not only look internally at how things are working in our own organization, but also at those groups and organizations that we're dependent on, either explicitly or implicitly, and may not even realize the extent to which problems in their environments can impact us. And the last story I have is from InfoWorld, and it talks about the three different types of DNS attacks, and a little bit about what you can do to mitigate each of them. And it's a little timely because I know that a lot of companies around the world have taken a look at what happened with the New York Times and Twitter, and have come to a pretty dramatic realization that this is an important thing, and hey, we could have been the New York Times, or our customer could have been the New York Times, or what have you. So I wanted to just review this article because I think it's interesting stuff to recap. The first type of attack is what's called cache poisoning, and this is really aimed at recursive DNS providers. And I think everybody that's listening to this podcast is probably painfully aware, but if you have a recursive DNS server and it's answering for some population, hopefully an internal constituency or maybe a customer base or what have you. But anyway, somebody can, let's say, query google.com and at the same time forge a response back from Google's name servers to that that recursive DNS server with a spoofed name. And if they're able to get lucky and do things right, they could potentially stuff that recursive name server with a fake name, and that's called cache poisoning. And then for the next day or however long the time to live is set on that domain, people are going to be redirected to the site that has been poisoned. And so it's a pretty old attack, but it still is a little effective now and again. Though I will tell you, it isn't a what I'll call a tool of mass destruction. It's a pretty narrow attack and affects a fairly narrow population. The other two attacks are what I'd call tools of mass destruction. And the first one is to take over the authoritative DNS server of your victim. And, you know, DNS servers are generally just servers. Sometimes they're outsourced, sometimes they're insourced. If an attacker is able to either directly compromise the DNS server or, let's say, phish the credentials or somehow in some way be able to modify the contents of that DNS server, they can redirect your mail, your web, whatever, to a site of their choosing. And so again, the appearance is that you've been hacked. This is not, in fact, what happened with Twitter and New York Times. The last one is, which was compromise of the domain registration. And so, in their case, a domain name registrar reseller for Melbourne IT apparently had been successfully phished by the Syrian Electronic Army. And so somebody at that reseller probably opened an email, which looked pretty convincing. They clicked on a link, which took them to a web page to log into their account, except it wasn't the web page they thought it was. They put in their username and password, bing, bang, boom, and now the Syrian Electronic Army is able to get into that account and take over a couple domains. And this is really very difficult because depending on how the attacker goes about it, they can make getting out of this situation really, really difficult. If you think about it, they can change passwords, they can maybe transfer the domain, they can do lots of fairly ugly things, and some of it's going to be dependent on the precautions that you take. And so one thing that the article doesn't really mention is that it's hypothesized that Twitter.com itself was not compromised or affected because it had some registrar locks enabled, which would probably have prevented the Syrian Electronic Army from actually making the changes they did to the other domains, which were not locked. Now, what's not clear to me is whether a reseller level account would actually have the ability to override those kinds of locks. I really won't claim to have that level of inside knowledge on how their business systems work, but it seems like a prudent precaution. Sometimes I think it does incur some extra costs, but if you don't have your domains protected with the registrar locks, you probably want to go and do that. You know, in the scope of, or in the scheme of things, this is not a common attack, right? Out of the 700 million domains or however many there are now, we've had exactly two in recent memory that this happened to. It's probably not going to happen to you. However, this is a pretty simple thing to go and turn on. So to me, it seems like a prudent precaution to go and do. And then the last thing I want to talk about on the podcast today is I've had a number of questions emailed to me about what I see happening, and just kind of netting it out, right? What I see happening as a result of a potential retaliation by the U.S. against Syria, and given what Syria has been doing to the New York Times and their history of attacking high-profile, really mission-critical things like the McDonald's Twitter feed, what do we see as potential opportunities of conflict? And personally, I think that the Syrian Electronic Army, again, is not all that sophisticated. I think if they had other weapons available to them, they probably would have used them. Although the one wild card here is, you know, Syria is very closely aligned with Russia, and so it's conceivable that Russia may have been, in addition to providing other kinds of weaponry, providing cyber weapons, if you will. We have no way of knowing that, and certainly, you know, the Syrian Electronic Army could be extremely sophisticated and have been planting these seeds for a long time, and they're just kind of lying in wait to press the big red button. But I don't think so. I think they're very, very comfortable with their phishing scheme, which is highly, highly effective. I think that if Syria itself takes on a retaliatory position, is probably going to be in that vein. What may change is their targets. And so you may say we may see them, instead of picking on media companies, we may see them start picking on, let's say, banks or other infrastructure players, and potentially use their tactics against those targets. And then the question becomes, what do all of the other countries who are aligned with Syria do in response? If anything, for instance, Russia has a pretty close alliance with Syria, as I mentioned, and Iran does as well, and they're both probably technologically superior to Syria, and so we may see them potentially lash out as a retaliation. But strategically and strictly from a military standpoint, there isn't a lot to gain by doing that. It's not like the United States would likely back down because they saw somebody attacking its banking system. It may make people feel better, but it isn't going to change the situation any. Now, what I think is potentially more likely is to see somebody like Anonymous, or I should say somebody under the name of Anonymous, use the opportunity to get some digs into the U.S., create some chaos, that sort of thing. I think that's probably relatively likely. You know, anytime a country does something like this, whether it's valid or not, we see some amount of people opposed to it, and from their perspective, it might make a lot of sense. But I think what's different these days is that the Anonymous banner, basically being available for anyone to adopt. Anybody can become Anonymous. Anybody can pull down their logo. Anybody can create a video. Anybody can post a manifesto on Pastebin and get people riled up to their cause. It's not a magical thing. And, you know, I've said it in previous podcasts, I think most of the impact of Anonymous these days is simply getting a reaction out of their press releases, if you will. So it's probably been 8 or 10 high-profile attacks have been announced since actually anything has been done. So the last several that I can recall have all been, you know, much ado about nothing. On the day of the announced attack, there's lots of hoopla released, but in the end analysis, you know, most of that stuff was not attributed to the attack at all. It was things that had been compromised previously or coincidentally or what have you. But that all creates chaos for us as defenders, because we have to deal with it. You know, we have to take threats seriously. If Anonymous posts a threat against my company, I I have to take it seriously. Not taking it seriously is a big mistake, especially if something were actually to come to pass, either directly related or indirectly related. Although I'll tell you, my feeling on the matter is that if you're going to do something in response to a threat like this, you probably want to consider whether doing that thing all the time makes sense, because generally there isn't any specific thing that's unique about those kinds of threats. Anybody could do that at any time. And so if you know of additional things that are prudent, given a heightened state of alert, you may want to consider figuring out a way to operationalize that so it's in place all the time, and you're not having to react in a knee-jerk fashion to some kind of a threat. Well, anyhow, that is all I have time for today. Has been a great long weekend. I hope, again, for those people in the U.S., you have had a enjoyable long weekend too. And I will talk to you again next week, and hopefully Mr. Cal will be joining me again for another episode of the Defensive Security Podcast. Just a reminder, if you have any comments, questions, feedbacks, ideas, whatever, send me an email to info@defensivesecurity.org. I do my best to answer every single one. You can find me on Twitter @DefensiveSec. My personal Twitter account is @MaliciousLink. And with that, I will talk to you all again next week. Have a great one. Bye.